Facilitative Conversations. Today we join Jessica Lester, Professor of Inquiry Methodology at Indiana University. Professor Lester has authored multiple articles and books on digital tools and qualitative research. We join her today with guest interviewer James Salvo.
Well, welcome, Jessica.
Hello, James.
So we wanted to talk about digital tools today. I guess the first place to start would be to address the issue of what sorts of digital tools are available to qualitative researchers?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question, in part because there are just so many, and there's more available every day. So the question is really what's not available. New innovations really are continuing to shape our research landscape in a lot of different ways. And in part, it's, opening up new possibilities for data collection, new forms of even what counts as a research context, as well as raising new ethical conundrums and questions about what counts as data, whether we should even be engaging with and in particular technological spaces, as well as the implications for making sense of meaning-making practices. But with that, just to name a few tools, and I'll say also digital spaces that are available to us, there's of course an entire suite of qualitative data analysis software packages. There's more and more that are coming in the market that offer, a range of different features for us as qualitative researchers and places to start. These can serve really as a place for both storing, organizing, analyzing your data. Some people have written about this as being like a laboratory, a one-stop shop where a lot of the work that we do as qualitative researchers, we can do it within these packages. But more broadly, we also have a range of tools that are available to us for supporting things like conducting a literature review or engaging with our literature. Data such as our literature can be stored in reference management systems. We might use other tools to engage with that literature. When we think about data generation or data collection, there are digital spaces where data may already exist that we might be interested in examining. So things like Instagram or Twitter might be a space that we engage in collecting data and examining what's happening in those spaces. And then, of course, perhaps what we're all even maybe pre-pandemic most familiar with are the tools that have long supported us in generating data, such as interviews or focus groups. So using video conferences platform, of course, it's all very much present for us now in this pandemic era. But those kinds of platforms have been around, and we have a pretty robust body of scholarship that has illustrated for quite a long time how we can leverage those tools to support generating researcher-oriented data, such as interviews or focus groups. And the thing that perhaps sits with all of us as qualitative researchers is recognizing that people today, it's more apparent to us in this era that we're living in, people are not just using technologies, but they're living through technologies. So for many of us, when we engage with a community and or a phenomenon of interest, one of the things that might surprise us that ultimately becomes foregrounded or part of our consideration is the ways that technologies are part of how people are making meaning and making sense of their lives. And that might be something that we ultimately come to focus on, in part at least.
Yeah, and I want to pick back up on at least two things that you said. So as digital tools and these digital spaces, as you say, open up new possibilities for us, and that really many of us find that and I really like this phrase of yours, living through technologies. What kinds of considerations as researchers do we need to make when we think about research design?
Yeah, so some colleagues and I that have written in this area for the last about 10 years have begun to kind of shift our thinking in this kind of consideration related to research design. And I'll say that how I would have answered this question maybe 10 years ago be different than how I'll answer it now, and how I would answer when, working with a student, for instance, that is thinking about digital tools and their research design. I think a really important starting place is actually considering how you theorize technologies in relationship to your actions as a researcher, as well as any, you know, potential future participants or research communities. I think it can go without saying that, you know, when we engage with technologies, we are co-researching with those technologies. But it's important to keep in mind that there are other theorizations of technologies, from, you know, technology as kind of more of an instrumental orientation to technology, to the idea that we as a researcher can maintain full control over the technology and don't have to be concerned with its impact on our research design. There's lots of different ways that we can orient to and make sense of the place of technology. So I think a really important starting point when you're thinking about research design is taking a pause and really fleshing out the place of technology and how you're theorizing and orienting to technology in and of itself. And then importantly, I do think it's important as you're beginning to sketch out your study is to think about all the different places that technologies might intersect with your work. And that, of course, you know, goes beyond just thinking about qualitative data analysis software packages, which I think is what we often just kind of default to. Oh, we're talking about technology that must be something to do with in vivo or Atlas or Deduce or MaxQDA. But really thinking about all the different tools that you might leverage in your work, as well as the spaces, such as digital spaces, that might be navigated by research participants or yourself as you begin to potentially engage in understanding the phenomenon of interest that you're really attending to. So I'll just say, kind of to summarize, like number one, really theorizing what technology is in the context of your research practice and your own kind of presuppositions to the place of technology and how you'll orient to technology. And then also thinking about where it comes into play with the various aspects of your research study, be it as you're thinking about data collection or data analysis or representation of your findings. Those are places where you might leverage and engage with technologies in a range of ways. We can't always predict those things, but we can certainly spend some time unpacking those potential interactions so that we can think through potential ethical conundrums, as well as, you know, the potential impacts to our own research plan and even our participants.
Yeah, so you mentioned about our interactions with technologies and co-researching with technologies. What are the sorts of different ways that we can theorize technologies, as you say?
Yeah, so there's a really sizable, helpful body of scholarship that is focused and has been for some time around theorizing technologies, and it hasn't necessarily always intersected with qualitative researchers or the work that we're engaged in. But I do think it's helpful for us to turn to make sense of our own kind of assumptions about technology. So we could take a critical theoretical perspective and orient to technologies from that particular paradigm. There's folks that have begun to think about technologies in connection to new materialism. Adams and Thompson, for instance, have written a book that has engaged with that perspective of technology in connection to the qualitative research practice. Activity network theorists have also taken up really particular perspectives to technology. And there are folks, I'll say, even within the qualitative research community that take up more instrumental kinds of approaches to technologies. So, you know, the views can range from the idea that, you know, a technology is neutral, has no influence over the researcher or the research practice. So all I have to do is use the technology and it will do exactly what I need it to do, and it won't influence me at all. To those that really attend to kind of the ways in which the work that we engage with when we leverage digital tools becomes so tightly linked to our practice that we're working together. And Adams and Thompson refer to this as like digital confluences, that it's inextricably linked, that we have to be attending to tools and spaces as these co-researchers. So all that to say, there's really a range of perspectives. And I would say that's why it's worthwhile to spend some time really unpacking your own orientation, given that that will shape how you leverage and how you interact with and enact a range of tools in your own practice.
Yeah, and going with that point, that how we theorize technologies shape how we act and interact. Can you talk a little bit about how these digital tools and digital spaces allow us to generate data?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is probably one of the areas that's most exciting for qualitative researchers, this idea that digital tools and digital spaces afford us new kinds of data to think with and to work with. So if we think about new digital spaces that are on the horizon now, that, for instance, were not on the horizon when I was a graduate student back in the day, things like Instagram, you know, I now have PhD students that setting gender performances in the context of Instagram and studying visuality in the context of Instagram. So one of the things that is really exciting about the explosion of digital tools and digital innovations is this idea that we have new forms of data where people are sharing in a range of ways through a range of modalities. Who they are, what their lives are, and how they're making sense of their everyday lives. So we have all these new kind of platforms where we can potentially access data. Of course, there are a whole suite of ethical considerations that go into accessing such data. Whether we should even be doing that is an important question. And then we also have new tools that allow us to collect data that we were perhaps long collecting in different ways. So just thinking about how video platform systems have created opportunities for us to invite participants to participate in an interview or a focus group who may not have been able to access it previously because of geographic distance. Those kinds of tools are really opening new spaces for us. With that said, I think it's important to recognize that while, you know, these range of digital tools and spaces are creating new opportunities for data generation, new kinds of data, new ways to collect data. Of course, we don't want to approach it with kind of rosy colored glasses, recognizing that, you know, a significant portion of the world's population doesn't have access to broadband internet. So we don't want to take the stance that, oh, they're cool, shiny new tools, we should all be using them, because it does create access and it creates opportunities for new data. Rather, we want to take, you know, really a critical reflexive stance of there are these tools. Who has access to them? What are the implications in relationship to my own study regarding who has access? What are potential possibilities for, you know, making my research study more accessible with tools or without tools? So really being reflexive and thoughtful about the decision-making process around adopting tools for generating data is equally important to being excited about all these new tools. Recognizing that we're going to have a suite of new tools every year. So really, really being critical, thoughtful, and even slow, so to speak, in our process of adopting them can be helpful.
Yeah, and I like your point about access and accessibility. And I think this ties into what you were saying with the ethics of thinking through these digital tools, spaces, innovations. Can you talk more about those concerns of accessibility and ethics in terms of managing the data that we generate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so first I'll just say a little bit more about, you know, accessibility and access. So I think there's at least two ways to consider this idea of accessibility and access. So one is whether potential participants or research communities can access the tools that were envisioning our study needing to access in order to participate or in order for the data to be generated. Another access question is related to the researcher themselves. Not all researchers have equitable access to digital tools and or spaces, be it that their institution doesn't have a license for a given digital tool or space, or the context where they live doesn't have access to a particular social media platform where there's minimal access because of, you know, a government kind of orientation to that particular platform. So I think that the question around access is both for the participant and research community as well as the researcher. So while it's really exciting, I think, to think about, for instance, how a QDOS package such as InVivo or MaxQDA can really serve as the one-stop shop where everything lives, and all of your work, from your literature review to organizing your data, to storing your data, to maintaining all of your memos, to working through your analysis process, whatever approach that might be, to even producing representations, to maybe doing, you know, cool and fun things if you're doing go-along interviews, of linking your interviews to geolinks, and really creating a rich kind of audit trail of your process. That's all really exciting. I love doing those things in my own work. But it's also important to keep in mind that many folks don't have institutional access to those kinds of software packages. And also many institutions don't have equitable access, meaning that sometimes a faculty member might have access, but graduate students might not have access. So access, I think, has to be considered both from the angle of, you know, the research participants and community, as well as the researcher and the research team themselves.
And in terms of equitable access, I know from a researcher standpoint, you know, we collect data and then we generate, we manage it, but we also analyze it. So in terms of the analysis that we produce and I guess ideally co-produce with our participants, can you talk more about these issues of equitable access as they relate to analysis?
I mean, there's a couple of different new innovations related to this that I think are exciting and helpful to think through with us. So first, I mean, one of the challenges that some researchers have faced is, if I engage in producing my analysis and storing all of my research process within InVivo, and I'm working on a research team, and my colleague is working within MaxQDA, historically there's been this stopping point of we can't share our files, and we're working on two different packages. But very recently, many of the QDOS qualitative analysis software packages developers worked closely to get together to develop what's referred to as the XML Exchange project, where across the majority of the software packages now, we can share our files. So that concern is less of a concern now. And I would say it's one of the biggest developments for the field in relationship to software packages, that we can now do that. I mean, it's a huge step forward for us as a field that we can work across packages, regardless of, you know, what our colleague is working on. We'll be able to share our work together. So that's it. That's a huge step forward, I would argue. And then also, you know, thinking about analysis, for those that might engage in analysis processes that they're envisioning their participants being a part of, and part of that process means that their participant is potentially engaged in a qualitative analysis software package. Obviously, some of that falls short if a participant who rarely would have access to the package would have access. But there are researchers who, you know, think creatively around that, and perhaps would bring, if they're a MaxQDA user, you know, bring Max on their iPad and engage with their participants together, working within the package themselves, and do some co-analysis. So there's lots of different, you know, creative ways that we can create access. Of course, we always want to come back to the question of why, like what will this afford me and my participants, what's meaningful about this, why is this useful, and maintain that critical reflexive stance so that we're not just adopting technologies because they're shiny and cool, but that we're doing it purposefully and recognizing that when we do, there are always consequences. Consequences to our research design, there's of course going to be ethical consequences and political consequences as well.
And you know, it's really interesting that I guess for these different software packages, we're moving away from the sort of platform capitalism, right? Where like, okay, well, if you get set, kind of like the Mac and PC, right? Like that, there's not really much communication, but with the open XML, is it that these are kind of coming together? That kind of leaves the question of another kind of accessibility that we as qualitative researchers don't often have access to, which is big data. And if we're kind of thinking in the sphere of big data in these sorts of digital spaces. What does that mean for us as researchers?
Yeah, I mean, you know, big data is certainly an area that is a hot topic for the methodological community across paradigms and has been for some time. I would suggest that we as a qualitative research community haven't jumped on board and being significant contributors to that conversation, but that there's space for us to do so. You know, there certainly is a growing interest in the amongst the new generation of qualitative methodologists that are coming up that are really interested in thinking about what big data means for us as qualitative researchers. We as qualitative researchers do have access, it's at our fingertips, to big data. I mean, if we think about Instagram data, discussion forums, that's big data. How do we work with it? What does it mean for our analysis? What does it mean for how we conceptualize the interpretation of units of analysis? I mean, there's important questions that are there for us to flesh out. I will say that there has been some recent writing in this area. Kathy Mills has written a book with Rutledge, I believe. It's titled Big Data for Qualitative Research. This is one of the newer discussions that I've seen in the literature around big data, and there's certainly room for us to think further about what this means. I do think some of the QDOS packages, the qualitative data analysis software packages, afford us opportunities to think about, when working in that package with big data, what kinds of features might we leverage and co-research with to make sense of our data. I also think that big data brings to the fore this idea that methodology is always in the making, and methodology is historically situated, culturally bound. It's not something that's meant to stand still, even if it's taught or presented as a historical artifact. It's really, from my perspective, meant to be responsive to the historical moment. And so one of the things that we're facing, one of the many things, is that we have an inundation of data. And so if you think back to, I mean, I remember one of my first qualitative classes, I read this Pokinghorn paper where he basically argued like qualitative data is language data. Well, we are inundated in our society with language, big data. And our colleagues in quantitative fields are really digging into the data and developing methodologies to really conceptualize what you do from that paradigm's perspective with big data. And I think we as qualitative researchers have an opportunity to also contribute to that conversation. And I think there's a desire for us to even think across paradigms when we're thinking about big data, you know, and using those paradigmatic differences as learning resources. So I think there's a future here where we can, you know, develop new methodological ideas and thinking and really expand on our work as qualitative researchers as we engage in what it seems like a lot of people are asking us to engage with, which is, what do I do with all this data? What do I do with this big data from a qualitative perspective? So James, I mean, you asked me the question, all I'm doing is asking you a question back. I don't have any answers apart from knowing that in my own work with graduate students, it's probably the primary topic that I hear from my methodology students that they're really interested in digging in, particularly those students that have an interest in thinking with others who are paradigmatically really different from their own thinking, thinking about what would it mean for us to think across paradigm, work at our own edges, and use our differences as learning resources and being responsive to this data that lives in front of all of us in this era.
Yeah, and I guess the big data question is literally a big question, but I think you've given us a lot to think about regarding our historical present, so to speak. So thank you. Is there any place that we can learn more about your work?
Yeah. So I generally keep an up-to-date list of my writing and my publication, publications on my Indiana University website. If you just look up Jessica Lester, Indiana University, my site will pop up for you. I'll just say that in relationship to this topic, my co-author Trina Paulus and I had a new book that just came out this year, 2022, qualitative research book that's focused on engaging in digital spaces. And it's building up some of our earlier work related to digital tools. So that's another place where you can learn a little bit more about my thinking related to this particular topic.
Well, thank you once again, Jessica.
You're very welcome, James. Thanks for the invitation.